Welcome to Free Thoughts. I'm Aaron Powell.
And I'm Trevor Burrus.
Joining us today is Eric Mack. He's a professor of philosophy at Tulane University. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Really glad to be here.
Today, we are discussing your new book titled Just Libertarianism. And so I thought Trevor and I spend a lot of time talking about libertarianism on Free Thoughts in all sorts of ways, but given the subject of your book, I thought it might be valuable for us to take a big step back and approach libertarianism from a much higher level and kind of a more abstract philosophical level than we often do. And so let me start by asking you then, in the context of political philosophy, what is libertarianism?
Well, I think at least as a first approximation, it's the view that individual liberty is the primary, if not the only, political principle. It's the only principle that justifies the characteristic action of political institutions, which is, if one's a libertarian, to protect liberty. And liberty here is understood as something like or exactly the capacity of people to have discretionary control over their own lives, over their own person, and over their own legitimate possessions. So liberty requires and presupposes that each person has these types of basic moral claims to her own life and to her own person and to the objects that she has legitimately acquired, and has a right to the discretionary control of those things.
In the broader context of political philosophy, where does libertarianism fit in? Or maybe a better way of asking this is it really a product of Enlightenment era thinking, or are there anyone in, say, Rome or Middle Ages who could be called a libertarian?
Well, you know, I reached not too far in the distant past. I did some work on the Dutch political philosopher Hugo Grotius. So he's a early 17th century figure. And at that time, people still argued primarily by citing ancient sources, which presumably had authority. And there are extraordinary number of quotations in Grotius back to Roman philosophers, especially Seneca. So Seneca looks like he was enormously influential. And maybe as we go along and we talk about Hume, and talk about Hayek, we'll see that a lot of the doctrines that Hume and then later Hayek have can be found in Seneca. So there is a type of, and the main doctrine that I have in mind when I say that is the idea that human beings require for their existence and happiness social cooperation, and that social cooperation can only be had if people abide by certain constraints in their behavior towards one another. And in Hume, this turns out to be keeping your hands off other people's property, keeping your hands off what other people have acquired through trade, and fulfilling your promises. And the notion is that these are the fundamental principles of justice. And so in Seneca, you get these doctrines. And Seneca himself and Croesus also cites a variety of actually church fathers. So if I can just add one more person, there's a fellow named John Chrysanthemum, Saint Chrysanthemum, who is a bishop in Constantinople. And he argued that one of the crucial proofs for the existence of God, really, was the existence of the Mediterranean, because the Mediterranean made trade possible. And trade exemplified cooperation and friendship among people, and ought always to be encouraged. So there are all these glimmerings of certain elements of a libertarian perspective that goes back at least to the Hellenistic period.
That puts me in mind of there's the Jains in ancient India. Had a similar to that meditation that the Mediterranean makes trade possible. They held up merchants as like one of the only really acceptable positions because it was the only one that was nonviolent, that your interactions with others were nonviolent.
Interesting. Yeah, I didn't know about that, but I'm sure we could find that among all sorts of perceptive people. And then also, there's obviously connected with this is various notions of the origins of property and the value of property as a social institution. And a lot of this is carried up into people like Grotius. Again, I'm trying to remember his dates. I think it's 1588 to something, 1583 to 1643, something like that, 45. So he's somewhat earlier than Hobbes, but he's very non-Hobbesian because he has a sort of proto-Lockean notion of people's rights.
So I want to talk through this tradition because much of your book is working through the intellectual tradition that is libertarianism. Yes. But I wanted to take a moment to get you to clarify something for our listeners that you said at the beginning, which was the thing that distinguishes libertarianism as a political philosophy from other political philosophies is that it places liberty as the highest political good, if not the only political good. And so that notion of like a political good, like what a political good is, because someone can hear that and say, well, wait a second, there's lots of things that matter. Liberty matters, but there's lots of other stuff that matters too. And should that stuff not be the concern of politics as well?
Yeah. Let me remind you that I said as the fundamental political principle, I think it's dangerous to talk about it as a good, partly because one then says, well, there are all these other goods. The distinctive thing about liberty is that it's what each of us can demand of one another. There are all sorts of other things that are good for us or good for particular people, but they cannot demand it with moral propriety, demand it from one another. So the special thing about liberty is that receiving liberty from other people, getting liberty from other people, simply requires that they not impinge upon one, that they not trespass upon one. It simply requires that they leave one alone to live in peace. So liberty makes a very modest claim on other people. It doesn't require that people give up their own projects or their own pursuits. It doesn't require that people have to serve your ends. It just requires that people have to not interfere with you in your decisions about your own person, your own liberty, your own possessions. And so in some sense, a very weak claim. It's a stringent claim. The case for my demanding from other people liberty is fundamentally more strong than the case for my demanding from other people that they assist me, that they serve me, that they make me happy, or anything of that sort. And since it's the only thing that has the status of something that each of us can demand of others, it's the only thing that each of us can coercively require of others. It's the only thing that justifies us in ever using coercion against others is if they refuse to give us liberty.
Now, people who might be listening to this and thinking, who are not libertarians and thinking, well, that just explained everything about libertarians, which is they don't care about helping people. They don't care about assisting and extremely atomistic, just want to live their lives and keep your hands off my stuff. Is that accurate as a portrayal? Some people could have heard what you just said and said it sounded just like that.
Yeah. No, it's not. First of all, of course, the claim to liberty is not a claim to live as a hermit. I mean, if you choose to live as a hermit, that would be protected by your claim to liberty. But the crucial thing about liberty is that you're allowed to associate with other people who you choose to associate with on your own terms. You're not required to serve or associate with people who are living a different sort of life. You're required to make them, you're required to allow them to live the lives they choose. But you're in no way Are you limiting how other people can act? And now to get to the other part, liberty is not at all the entirety of how one should live one's life. It would be extremely ridiculous life if you went around saying, my sole concern is to maintain my liberty with respect to other people. Everyone has a claim to liberty precisely because that's what gives everybody the right and the possibility of living a valuable life. And living a valuable life includes many, many more things than just being at liberty, including very, very especially all sorts of social relationships. So the individualism that's involved here, and there is a strong individualism that's involved here, is an individualism that says to people, you may proceed to try to live the life that you think will produce the greatest amount of happiness or well-being for you. But one important piece of advice, which can be given by anybody, whether they're libertarians or not, is that that friendship and standing in loving relationships with other people and standing in various sorts of community with other people, all of that is crucial for almost everybody to a desirable life. The way one can have a life with that sort of desirable relationships depends upon one being free to choose the terms and the relationships that one wants to have with other people.
Libertarianism is something of a big tent. There's a spectrum of views within it, from outright anarchists on maybe the one end through to, say, classical liberals on the other, although I think you kind of distinguish classical liberals from libertarianism proper. But can you tell us what that spectrum looks like and where the disagreement is between the people along it?
Sure. So I would say, first of all, that the anarchists that we're talking about are within the libertarian portion of this spectrum that runs from libertarianism to robust classical liberalism to somewhat less robust classical liberalism. And the key, of course, that spectrum, and then I'll come back to the anarchism issue. The key is that, let's call them hardcore libertarians, think that liberty is not only the primary fundamental political principle, but it's the only political principle. It's the only thing that may be coercively required of other people. The only thing that can be coercively required of other people is that they respect your liberty. And they interpret, hardcore libertarians interpret liberty in a way that excludes requiring the service of other people. So liberty is understood as merely requiring that you be left alone in your voluntary relationships with other people. There can be complications so that, for instance, someone like Nozick or myself or people like Locke also defend a certain type of Lockean proviso, which says that if you act in certain sorts of ways that preclude other people from ever having any opportunities, then they have a just complaint against you. And those sorts of actions can be forbidden. But as you move over into sort of classical liberal territory, you might have people who endorse a social safety net of some sort and think that it's either legitimate to compromise people's liberty to require them to support a social safety net, or they might have some sort of modification of the notion of liberty that allows them to say that a genuine respect for liberty requires that there be a social safety net. So there's a range of marginal adjustments away from hardcore libertarianism. And as you make those marginal adjustments, you move more to a classical liberal stance. And if you make more of those adjustments, for instance, get to the point of saying that that the demand for liberty is consistent with requiring people to pay taxes to produce public goods, then you've moved over to a sort of a less robust classical liberalism position, maybe what we should call a small state position. Someone like Richard Epstein would be an example. So that's the spectrum between very hardcore libertarians, classical liberals who will allow a greater range for certain sorts of coercive actions, and then small state folks who may want to call themselves libertarians. Maybe they should be called libertarians, but they're further away from hardcore libertarians than robust classical liberalism. So there's that. With respect to the anarchism, it's only going to be, I think it's fair to say, it's only going to be hardcore libertarians who favor anarchism rather than minimal government. And there, there's an extremely complicated set of arguments. The anarchists argue primarily that if you're against coercion, then first of all, you have to be against coercive taxation. And so small state classical liberalism is out. Also, if you're against coercion, the anarchists argue you have to be against the coercion that suppresses competitors with the state. Agencies who put themselves forward as organizations that will provide you with the service of protecting your rights. Anarchists argue that when the state suppresses those potential competitors, it violates those people's rights. And anarchists argue that when you have only a coercive monopoly supplying certain services, those services are going to be shoddier and more costly. So there's that special debate between the anarchists and the minimal state libertarians, which I talk about in one of the later chapters of the book.
Now, you mentioned Locke, and earlier you mentioned Hobbes, and since we talked about anarchy, where does Locke and maybe Hobbes fit into this? Because he gets at least a lot of people who like classical liberalism and libertarianism talk about Locke a bunch. Where does he fit into it? And also for the anarchism element, so it seems that both Hobbes and Locke were trying to justify the existence of a state, thinking that the state required justification, which I'm not sure was a very popular view in, say, 200 years before either of them, that the state even needed justification whatsoever. How much is also part of this question of what are human beings like naturally without the state? Because I feel like Hobbesians believe that human beings are kind of mean to each other, and Lockeans tend to believe that we're more cooperative together. And how does libertarianism tend to look at those issues?
So I think the crucial thing that Hobbes and Locke have in common is that they deny the existence of natural rulership, right? And so no one is born a king, no one is born a subject, no one is born a ruler, no one is born a master, no one else is born a servant or a slave. So that's the crucial thing they have in common. And the crucial thing about the state of nature, which is is thought of at least analytically as the origin, the baseline from which we have to operate. The crucial thing about the state of nature is that there isn't any state in the state of nature. And we have to, if there's going to be a state, it has to be created. And we now have to know what the justification of creating a state would be and what sort of state could possibly be justified. The crucial thing about Hobbes versus Locke is that for Hobbes, in the state of nature, there aren't any principles of justice. There aren't, properly speaking, any rights. The state of nature is, for Hobbes, a type of moral free-for-all. And because it's a state of moral free-for-all, it's a horrendous state, right? It's a state in which nobody ever hesitates to do something because they think it might be unjust, because they know nothing is unjust. And everybody knows that other people realize that nothing is unjust. And so one has this spiral downward into violence and the war of all upon all. And so for Hobbes, the only way out is a sovereign who not only rules in some way, but the sovereign gets to create justice, because there isn't any justice outside of the will of the sovereign. And so if the sovereign creates justice by issuing commands, and whatever the sovereign commands is justice, and therefore the sovereign cannot possibly act unjustly. For Hobbes, we have to create a sovereign, because the alternative is this horrible state of nature. But once one has a sovereign, there is no way to complain as a matter of justice about what the sovereign does, because justice is nothing but the word of the sovereign. So Locke is responding to that and to other people who hold that position. And the crucial thing in Locke is this idea that, as he puts it, the state of nature has a law of nature to govern it. And the law of nature is a moral law, right? And it's the law that primarily consists of people having the sort of basic rights that I was talking about before. Locke's view is that precisely because each person has, in a sense, a life of his own to lead, is precisely because each person has goals of their own, including for Locke, the goal of getting to heaven, that each person needs discretionary control over their own life in order to best pursue his or her goals. And because people need this discretionary control, the appropriate response of each of us to other people, even in the state of nature, is to allow people to go their own way, not to interfere with people. Also, of course, to interact with them, but only on voluntary terms. And so for Locke, there are these natural rights. And Locke, however, thinks that, as many people would think, that although people may have some regard for these natural rights in the state of nature, there's also a lot of problems with people being the judges of their own cases. There's a lot of problems about there being honest disagreements about whether certain rights have been violated or not. And Locke thinks that the obvious solution to this is the creation of political society. But political society is only given the task of better formulating and better protecting the rights that exist in the state of nature. And so if political society or the government that political society establishes violates those rights, it's acting unjustly and may justly be removed, eliminated. And so for Locke, there's a very, very strong doctrine of just resistance, just violent resistance to unjust authority, whereas for Hobbes, it's totally impossible that there be just resistance to unjust authority. It's impossible for any authority to be unjust, according to Hobbes. So it's with Locke and maybe some of these earlier people, that we get this notion. Some of this was present in some of the Thomistic tradition. It's with Locke primarily, though, we get this notion that that there's certain fundamental principles about how individuals ought to behave towards one another, certain fundamental moral constraints on how people ought to conduct themselves in their interactions with other people. And everybody is subject to those constraints, including any political authority that is created. And so if a political authority acts in some way that would be perceived as criminal if done by a local hoodlum, it's also criminal when done by a king. And so these great passages in Locke where he says, you know, what's the difference between a local thief and a king? Well, a king has a crown, the king has a lot of followers, but that doesn't make the crimes that the king commits any less crimes. And so once again, That's the basic Hobbes Locke story. And Locke, I hesitate a little bit to say that he's a Enlightenment person. He's there at the very beginning of the Enlightenment, right? So he's one of the people who sort of creates the Enlightenment. He's not living in an age of Enlightenment as yet. He's a major force, not only in terms of political theory, but also in terms of his epistemology for the Enlightenment.
So let's then turn to the next thinker that you explore in your walk through the major figures in the history of libertarian political thought is John Stuart Mill. So what did he contribute to this kind of strain that Locke got started?
Okay. So actually I would put Hume before Mill, and I would think that Mill is actually much more, I mean, Hume is much more important, but let's talk about Mill. I should say that in the book, I start off by saying that there are two major lines of philosophical thought that contribute to libertarianism. And it's not that every person who follows those lines of thought is a libertarian, but the lines of thought underwrite libertarianism. One is this natural rights view that we first find in a full-blown version in Locke. So that's this natural rights approach. Another approach is what I call cooperation to mutual advantage. And to stick in Hume here, Hume is the great presenter of that. And in the 20th century, Nozick carries on the Lockean natural rights approach. And in the 20th century, Hayek carries on the Humean cooperation to mutual advantage approach. When I started writing the book, I was focusing on those two approaches, this natural rights approach and this cooperation to mutual advantage approach. And I wanted to show the relationship between them and their compatibility to a very considerable extent. But there's another third type of approach, which I call the indirect utilitarian approach, which also has played a considerable role in attempts to underwrite libertarianism. And so Mill fits into this indirect utilitarian approach. And the other person I mentioned is who I like more is Herbert Spencer. So if I can say, go through this. So for Mill is deeply different on fundamental levels from Locke. Mill, as almost everybody knows, thinks that the correct and fundamental and really the only fundamental moral principle is the greatest happiness principle. And the greatest happiness principle tells us that between two states of affairs in society, the one that has the greatest aggregate happiness minus aggregate unhappiness, the one where the net gain in happiness is greatest, that's the best social state. And when you're deciding how to act, you should always perform the action which will most likely induce that best social state. So we all ought to be running around doing the best we can to figure out how we can make the most happiness in the world, even if generating that happiness requires diminishing some people's happiness. So this is Mill's utilitarianism. But Mill is also a friend of liberty and individualism. And so at least in parts in Mill, and certainly this is a major part of Mill's important essay on liberty, Mill seems to say, you know, it's a mistake for us to always be thinking about which particular action will most promote the aggregate good, most promote the aggregate happiness. What we really want to do is think of the social conditions that on the whole and for the most part produce happiness. And in some places he says the social condition that most produces happiness is liberty. In other places he says the social condition that most produces happiness is security. They're actually pretty much the same. They're both cases in which people are not subject to interference. And so sometimes Mill says, What we should do, instead of trying in each of our particular actions to promote the greatest happiness, we should instead promote the general social condition, which, if held to rigidly, will produce over the long run the most happiness. And Mill's view on liberty is that general social condition, which over the long run will produce the most happiness, is liberty. We should not violate people's liberty in particular cases, even when it seems as though violating it in those particular cases will promote the most happiness, because the most important thing, the thing with the greatest, deepest utility, is that we protect people's liberty, because in some way, the protection of liberty is always going to produce in the long run the greatest amount of happiness. Or we should always protect people's security. So I myself am not a fan of this view, but there are very smart people who propose this view. And it's also, as I said, the view that that is developed in a much more libertarian way by Herbert Spencer.
And, yeah, we'll talk about him for a bit, because most people know his name now, unfortunately, as a social Darwinist who wanted—
The most unfairly maligned person in the history of ideas, I think.
Yeah. He was a big deal for a while too.
He was probably considered the most famous and most impressive philosopher, not just political philosopher.
Yeah, I was struck several years ago. I read Will Durant's Story of Philosophy, which was written in like the 20s or 30s. And he has, I think, almost nothing on Hume and Kant, but he has a very long chapter on Herbert Spencer. And it was striking how much this guy, like his importance, and then he just kind of vanished.
That caused Spencer, I mean, not just sort of a type of personal disappointment, but in ways that I don't fully understand, he had notions about progress and that he was on the side of history, right?
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, history turns against him. And he was a very unhappy guy, even more so in his old age than as a young man. But Spencer's social statics, especially the early editions when he's still very, very radical as a libertarian, pretty much as a libertarian, starts out just as Mill, saying, look, the fundamental principle of morality is the happiness principle. That's our ultimate standard, happiness understood as the aggregate happiness. But he then says a whole bunch of things that you'd also find in Hayek. He says, but actually, each person has a different conception of happiness. There's really no one common conception of happiness. Each person has a different conception of happiness at different times of their lives. There's no way that we can compare the value of these different types of happiness. And so there's no way that we can really say if A's happiness goes up 5 units at the expense of B's happiness going down 2 units, that the world is overall better off. We can't say that because we can't compare these different types of happiness. And therefore, the only thing that we can say is we want a world in which everybody's happiness rises. And the only way to have a world in which everybody's happiness rises is to have a world in which nobody is allowed to pursue their happiness in ways that prevents other people from pursuing their happiness. And he calls that the law of equal freedom. Right? So we want to have the law of equal freedom, and that's the fundamental condition. This sounds now like Mill. That's the fundamental condition we have to bring about and enforce in order over the long term to have the greatest chance for the greatest happiness being attained.
Now, does that make him – so he is a utility or consequentialist of some sort?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. And, you know, if you – you both will know that it's really Bentham that is the real true example of the standard utilitarian, who says always do the thing in the particular case which will most generate happiness. And it's Bentham that Spencer attacks, and he calls this the expediency utilitarianism. But Spencer says, I'm going to enunciate what he calls rational utilitarianism. And rational utilitarianism is this utilitarianism which takes account of the general, all sorts of general facts about human nature and social interaction. And this is what ultimately leads him to this conclusion that the only thing we can give as a formula and a guide for increasing aggregate utility over the long run is this principle of equal, this law of equal freedom. It's a little bit more complicated than that, but the first principle that has to be enforced and which people have to evolve to the point where they naturally abide by it is this law of equal freedom. Then I'll just quickly mention, then he says, I'm going to talk about the rights that are implied by the law of equal freedom. And those are rights primarily to liberty in the sense of, you know, just action. It's rights to control your body. It's rights to, he has writing in the early 1850s, he says we have to, women have the same rights as men, of course. Children have rights. So it's very, very radical. And then there are other components to it. The one I'll mention now, which is highly relevant to the discussion we had about the anarchist versus non-anarchist, is he has a chapter in the early edition of Social Statics called The Right to Ignore the State. So if you want to withdraw from association with the state, you have every right to do so. And so the American individual anarchists thought that he was a comrade on these matters. And when he eliminated that chapter from later editions of the Social Statics, they felt that he had betrayed them. As he had.
that brings up the follow-up question, because you keep mentioning the early editions of Social Statics, and those are the ones where we get the robust radical libertarian view. So what changed in the later editions besides the removal of this chapter?
The other crucial, the other shocking chapter in the early editions, and I say editions, I don't know whether it really whether this chapter survived the first edition. I'm not sure, you know, when the different editions took place.
But it was at some point it was taken out.
Yeah. The other chapter that was removed was the chapter on the right to the earth, where Spencer argues that the earth, that is say all land, all natural resources, are the joint property of all of mankind. And although he thinks of it in terms of society by society, so all the natural resources of great in the area called Great Britain are really the joint property of British society, and every one of us is an equal joint owner. And he has complicated arguments for why he draws that conclusion, and he decides that the way this should be worked out is that if you, and he's thinking mostly of an agricultural society, if you want to make use of a certain amount of land, then society will rent you that land. And part of the deal is that what you grow on the land through this contract that you have with society, or what you produce from the mine through this contract that you have with society, that becomes your private property, but nobody ever acquires private property in raw material. That remains the property of society. And in the book, I go on when I talk about late 20th century left libertarianism. I go back to Spencer and say Spencer is the source, the major source of this view. That is the view that everyone has rights over themselves and their own liberty, but there's some sort of initial, original, equal rights to the earth, right? And this, the problem with that sort of view, which I also talk about, is the two things actually come into conflict. there's no way to enforce operationalize this idea of our equal joint right to natural resources in ways that won't infringe upon people's rights over themselves. And Hillel Steiner, who's a very good friend of mine, is, to my mind, the great 20th century representative of this libertarianism.
An essay on rights, is that the one you're
yes, talking about? Yes, yes, yes. So an incredibly smart guy. And there's a section in the book where I present his position and then criticize it. And part of that is to try to show that this variation on libertarianism, which introduces this egalitarian notion of equal rights to raw material, won't fly. That introduction of an egalitarian element, a deep egalitarian element, cannot be made consistent with what Steiner would describe as a doctrine of self-ownership.
If we're talking about like left libertarianism in that regard, you hear start these concerns about equality matter to left libertarians more. But it also seems to me that left libertarians care about power in a broader sense than just coming from the government. Is that something that libertarians should be concerned? Power from the corporations, power from whoever. Yeah.
So there are really two groups of people going under that rubric. There's people like Steiner and several other people. Peter Valentine is one in the U.S. So there are those people who explicitly endorse the idea that that the earth is either originally jointly owned by everybody, or everybody is born with a right to an equal share. So let's call it the Spencer derived left libertarianism. And then there are people like Roderick Long and Gary Chartier, and they are more like they may also be anarchists. I'm not sure. All of them probably are, but they're descendants of these 19th century American individualist anarchists who were at least highly suspicious of any income that didn't derive from labor. So they're highly suspicious of rent income. They're highly suspicious of interest income. And there's also a general tendency to emphasize, maybe in some cases quite properly, the amount of income that corporations achieve through illicit monopolies, monopolies that are supported coercively by the state. So they think that but the difference is, I think those left libertarians, that second group, on ultimate principles, are fully within what I would call the main libertarian camp, but they have they deviate by having these suspicions about rental income or interest income.
And other sources of power and control.
Other sources of power too. And I think at least some of them are more, I don't know what you, culturally left.
That's probably true.
Yeah. Although probably not all of them. So there are these two different types of left libertarians around.
So I guess relatively quickly, because we're drawing to our hour, what Nozick and Hayek, as we move into the 20th century, and as you said, they're building, each of them is building on one of these two forks and the kind of
That's
foundations.
Right.
What do they specifically contribute?
Yeah, good. So one of the motives for writing the book was that I've done a lot of colloquia, often through IHS, and other sorts of organizations in which I, will meet with graduate students, and often in philosophy, sometimes political theory or legal theory. And I've been impressed by the lack of depth of understanding of these two great times. I think these both Nozick and Hayek were incredibly, you know, brilliant and insightful, and but complex. And so those two chapters of the book, one chapter on libertarian foundations, which deals both with Nozick and Hayek, and then this chapter on property rights and economic justice. In both of those cases, I try to explain, in some cases, maybe help out each of these figures to show how interesting and deep their arguments are. In the case of Nozick, I try to develop his own arguments for what we can call Lockean natural rights, and clearly don't have time to talk about that, but it goes back to this, and I try to show that Nozick sort of at the end of the, I think at the end of the preface to Anarchy, State, and Utopia says, you know, one of the things this book doesn't do is give you a wholly worked out theory of people's natural rights.
Isn't the line is something like there are words other than final words or something?
Right? Yes.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I love
so
that line.
For some reason, people have taken this to mean, or they say they think it means, that he hasn't offered any arguments at all. Just the way people say that about Locke. They say Locke just asserts these rights, or Locke just says that God created these rights. None of these things are true. I mean, all these people are working pretty hard. And what I try to do really is to lay out as carefully as I can what Nozick's arguments for these rights are and compare those arguments and show how they're parallel to, but in some ways better than, John Rawls's arguments for his position, right? And so strategically there, the idea is, well, everyone recognizes, perhaps in scare quotes, everyone recognizes that Rawls is a great genius. What do you know? Nozick's arguments run along the same lines, but they're more, they better reach his conclusions than Rawls's comparable arguments do. So that's one thing I do.
And for Hayek, who is of course all very complex in terms of economic theory, legal theory, justice theory. I don't think a lot of people really think of him as a political philosopher because he won the Nobel Prize in economics, but he probably did more political philosophy than anything else.
Certainly from the mid 40s onward. And so I also try that Foundations chapter to show how Hayek tries to defend what he calls these rules of just conduct without making a moral argument, because he grew up in Vienna in the 1920s when people thought you couldn't possibly make a moral argument about anything. So he thinks, I can't do that. But he has this very interesting idea about how if you make deep mistakes about the nature of society or the nature of law, you're going to be led to endorse certain values, which he thinks are false values. And if he can correct people's understanding about the nature of society and the nature of law, then the values that have been dethroned by the mistaken social science will reemerge. And basically, the idea is he wants to show how a society of cooperation to mutual advantage, where people can live in peace and harmony with one another while each retains their own personal goals and projects, he wants to show how such a society is possible, but only possible if it is based upon certain moral principles. And these moral principles are very much like the moral principles that Hume talks about, and in many ways, very much like the moral principles that Locke and Nozick talk about. So there's that, and then there's a chapter, as I said, on property rights and economic justice. And there I try to lay out Nozick's arguments for what he calls his historical entitlement theory, and Hayek's arguments, which are some of which are quite bad, I think, but some of which are better, where he attacks what he calls social justice, the notion of social justice. And this is not what we mean by social justice today, but where he attacks the idea that there is some sort of idea of economic justice, which requires the state to step in and create certain particular types of distribution of wealth. And rather than that, he, like Nozick, endorses the view that essentially what people acquire peacefully through their own efforts or through voluntary trade with one another, that is what their just holdings are. And it cannot at least be claimed that those holdings are unjust. So there too, I work very hard at trying to give expression to these ideas, and I think in a couple of cases, generous expression. So to make available to people a better understanding of what both these guys were doing.
So you have there's a bonus chapter of that's available online as a PDF, and we'll put a link to that for our listeners in the show notes that goes through some other arguments, Steiner's and David Schmidt's and Rasmussen in denial, and some kind of more novel or outside of this main framework sorts of arguments. But setting those aside, and I encourage our listeners to go and check out that chapter because it's really interesting stuff. Maybe close with, are there new emerging novel or particularly interesting or promising arguments for libertarianism that you see developing now that you're excited about or think could be, you know, among these canonical ones at some point in the future?
I guess my short answer is no. So this puts me at odds with lots of younger than I am libertarian political philosophers who I admire and think are very, very smart. But I think there's been a movement in the last at least 10 years, maybe more, to argue that to maintain that there isn't really much difference between the moral views of socialist theorists or protectionist theorists or whatever, and libertarian or classical liberal theorists. Rather, this tendency has been to say there's really just disagreement about the empirical facts. We all kind of agree morally on what a nice person is like, but some nice people get economics wrong, or they get sociology wrong, or they get history wrong, and that's why they become socialists or interventionists. And we just have to help people see better the conclusions that we all want to draw, given our common moral beliefs. I don't believe that. I believe that there are these deep moral divisions between people. And I also believe that one can rationally address these deep moral divisions, although people's attachments to their own views may be strong enough that they refuse to change their minds no matter what. But So I'm in this way a throwback to the view that, and this is contrary to Hayek too, to the view that there really is a deep divide between libertarian and classical liberal thinking, and let's just call it socialist thinking on the other hand. And I think the fundamental dividing point is between people who think that that it's right and proper for individuals to pursue their own happiness and well-being and live their own lives, and that social order ought to accommodate this liberty of people to pursue their own lives. That's on the one hand, that's the good libertarian classical liberal side, and people on the other hand who think that that's a completely inadequate morality, that a really moral society will identify, you know, some great radiant goal that we all ought to pursue and will direct people, channel people, or if necessary, force people to contribute to that radiant goal. And I'm an opponent of that. And I think all the good historical people the best historical people in the libertarian and classical liberal view are opponents to that. And so about the book, I would say one of the things I try to do, and I try to do it without too much of a heavy hand, is to show that in all the people that I discuss, including the people in that extra bonus chapter, the one persistent thing is this belief in individuals and the propriety of people pursuing their own happiness or their own well-being, and the rejection of the idea that there's some sort of a higher social good that justifies stepping in and subordinating people to that alleged higher good.
Thanks for listening. Free Thoughts is produced by Tess Terrible. If you enjoy Free Thoughts, please subscribe to us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. If you'd like to learn more about libertarianism, visit us on the web at www.libertarianism.org.